an academic day today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
Bill Hebert is busy in marriage and family counseling, but he also has an academic side. We'll check that today on Scribble.
Bill, every time I check up on you, which isn't too often, but you seem to be somewhere around the world giving a paper.
That's true.
I would think that would be an incredibly difficult position because the paper is supposed to have some content, but at the same time, it's supposed to keep the people at the conference awake, and those don't always go together.
Well,
how do you do it?
Well, I have an advantage because I'm speaking about doing therapy, so it's in the context of something that's practical. Now, in approximately, it's the middle of November, I will be in Istanbul, and it is the 10th anniversary of the Turkish Family Therapy Association, which I am reputed to have begun. I guess it's because I urged the Turks to form their own association. So they invited me back for the anniversary, and I'm supposed to speak about working with multicultural families. Well, that's both a theoretical issue in the sense that there are some concepts about how you work with multicultural families, but I also have to speak about multicultural families. So I follow the old Reuben K. Youngdahl method of preaching. When I do an academic paper, if you ever went to Mount Olivet Lutheran Church when Youngdahl was the popular pastor of their 12,000 parishioners there, he used to make a story, a point, a story, a point, a story. And so whenever I do a presentation like this, I'll speak about a concept of working with multicultural families, but then we'll illustrate that with a couple I've worked with, so that I keep the tension between what is the theoretical background of whatever it is I'm talking about, and then how does it look practically. And most of the time, as in Turkey, I'm not speaking to academic professors of counseling. I'm speaking to therapists, so that even though they may have a university position, the fact is they're there because of their wanting to improve their skills in counseling. So I always go back and forth between this, between point and illustration, point and illustration. And many of the younger people would use their illustration by, or would demonstrate it by playing a clip from a counseling session, which I tend not to do because when you select a clip out of a session, it sort of implies that the whole session looks like this, and there are often times in counseling in which there's not a lot happening. And so I tend to not use clips, but I have used them to illustrate the session. So does that give you a framework for understanding what I'm doing in these
settings? Yeah, but you also do it well. And I heard you once give a talk about your preparation for where you are now, and you described it as zigging and zagging, right?
Right.
I mean, you've gone this way, and then you've gone that way. At one point, you preached and you know, I think you've gone to a seminary and you've done sociology and stuff. Where along the way did you learn to write, or have you always?
Well, back in the 1960s, Robert Stammen was the director of the University of Iowa Counseling Service. He came to me one day and said, "I'd like you to consider coming to Iowa and doing a congress with us there. We're having a big, I forgot even exactly what that conference was called." And so he said, "We'd like you to come and speak." Well, the people who were there were Margaret Mead and me. And Margaret Mead was talking about, of course, whatever was going on in America in the 1970s. And I was there talking about couple therapy. And after that particular workshop, Bob said to me, I think we ought to consider doing a book. And so he reached out to a publisher, and the publisher came back and said Richard Clemmer had produced a very popular book, but he had died while jogging. And they wanted to know if we wanted to revise his book. And I said to Bob, absolutely. It's the easiest way to get published is pick up a book that they want to re-edit. So we did that, and then they came back and said, how about doing a book on premarital counseling? So that's sort of how we started writing. Now, Bob and I had a particularly good working relationship. He loved research, and I was the practical person. So I would dictate the chapter, and I'd always dictate it rather than handwrite a book.
Why?
Because I dictate as part of the therapy, because you're always dictating notes. So I'm used to recording what I'm saying. And so I found it so much easier to do the book by using a dictaphone.
Does it change your style?
Yes, because when I do a book, then I have to think in terms of how you read a book rather than how you hear a person speaking. So I sort of put on a different mindset, and I think about how it looks on paper, and I usually dictate walking around the room and with my eyes closed because I'm trying to think about how it appears in written form. And then Bob would take that and add all the research in. So I would make the points, and then he would go into the literature and find all the appropriate references.
Okay.
And I just spoke to him yesterday, as a matter of fact, because one of my former interns has been approached by the big company in Minneapolis who is does the premarital inventory about coming on board as their researcher. And I said, I think we ought to redo the book and involve this man. So I don't know if this helps you, but I sort of, again, wandered into writing, and we've done four or five books. I've forgotten exactly how many. But this is the teamwork we've always had. I provided the narrative, and he provided the research.
Well, it's interesting that how can the narrative come first and then... You know, I imagine you're doing hours and hours of research, but apparently...
No, because it's a book about counseling again.
Okay.
So it's a book about how to. In the field, it's somewhat negatively referred to as a cookbook. And it isn't a cookbook in the sense we say you do it this way, one, two, three, but it is a cookbook in the sense that we say these are the topics that need to be considered when working with a premarital couple. And so... And so I would always flesh that out. In fact, that's the way I've done all the writing I've ever done, is I always want a rough draft, even no matter how awful it is, I dictate a rough draft first. I want to work from something rather than sit down and think out the idea and then write it. I'm an extrovert, so I think by talking. I don't think and then write. Now, there's a rather famous man who died several years ago named Paul Watzlawick, or Watzlawick as Americans say, who worked at the Mental Research Institute in Palo Alto, Austrian by background, brilliant man, wrote The Pragmatics of Human Communication, and colleagues told me that he put a yellow tablet down, he put six pencils down, and he wrote one draft, and that was it.
Hmm.
Well, you know, I can't write that way. And in fact, I had my reporter for the Family Therapy News interview him, and he insisted on a copy, so we sent him a copy, and he wrote back and said, I do not give permission to publish this interview. And I wrote back and I said, Dear Dr. Watzlawick, I realize you're used to finely crafted manuscripts, but this is the first time our readers will have had a chance to read you in the way you would sound if they were sitting in front of you. And he sent the letter back, and he wrote on the bottom, publish it.
That's interesting, because I've always said I never know what I think until I hear what I say.
That's an extrovert. Extroverts always talk out loud.
But I'm interested in you talking about multicultural families in Turkey.
Well,
I mean, are you kidding me?
Well, I am surprised that they want me to speak about this because they're 98% Muslim.
Yeah.
And so I've wondered what in the world is behind this because It is just, you know, for us, this is very common and very important topic. But I guess I should ask them why they've chosen this. But I guess it's because I've been there. And I have worked with a few multicultural Turkish families, but they're not many.
I would think not, but because this, the nationalism is so strongly ingrained there. But are there different, say, tribes of people and so on? Do they count that as multiculturalism?
Well, they may count the Sunni
and Shia, yeah.
And Shia, and then the third one,
Wahhabi.
No, it starts with A.
Oh, you got me.
I can't conceive of that, but they are different, and I know there's a struggle. For example, among very conservative Muslim families, men will sometimes take several wives, even though that's not legal in Turkey. And so they're called religious wives. And so if there's a divorce, they, of course, get nothing because they're not legally part of the marriage. Other than that, I just can't imagine what is multicultural about Turkey.
Mm-hmm. So when you give these papers, I'm assuming you give them in English. Are they translated?
Yeah, the translator stands beside me and translates, and I've used the same woman for, I don't know, 6 years, so she knows everything I'm going
to
say.
So you have to keep that into consideration, yes, as you write these papers, right?
That they're... Well, and the book that I wrote on family therapy is translated into Turkish.
Okay.
And so and she did that. When I'm talking to the group, I will stop after every sentence or two and translate, which I like because it means that you have to hone down what you're saying to the central points. And it's some people find that very difficult, but I don't mind that. It allows me to, as I said, think about where I'm going to go next because I could fill up hours of material, so I have to then condense it down. And it's, there'll probably be 200 people there, I would guess. And she'll pick up, and she'll go on after even she'll fill in what I didn't say. So because she knows me so well, and she's been here, and I've taught, and she's done this, so she knows where I'm going. So sometimes she'll just go ahead and amplify my idea.
Do you write your speeches out?
I only do an outline.
So you know what you're going to say, but the way you say it occurs to you at the time.
Right.
And you say your books, you do principally in transcribing?
I dictate, yes.
You dictate, that's it.
I guess I don't transcribe. The secretary transcribes, yeah, I dictate.
Well, my command of English gets a little halting at times. But yeah, so... That's an interesting way of proceeding. I've often thought that might not be a bad way to go.
Well, every intern we get has never done this, so they have always used to typing up their own notes. So they resist and will balk at doing this because it's awkward for people. But I maintain that dictating forces you to conceptualize what you want to say and to say it in a clear manner. And so after people have done a year of dictating, they will say, this was helpful to me. So I think that way. And so I'm so used to doing this after 50 years that it's just very automatic for me.
So do you ever have dictator's block? I mean, people have writer's block. Me, I do all the time. I mean, do you ever, or you just keep going?
I keep going. I want to work from something.
Okay.
I don't want to sit and wait till something comes. When Derek and I, if we do a news release or we do a grant request, I put it out there. And then I say, here, take a look at it. And then he'll do all kinds of changing. But I want to work from something.
That's what motivates you to write a book? Is it a commission or an impulse or what?
Well, it was an idea that was important at the time. The premarital counseling our book stands as one of the foundational books in my co-author, Bob Staben in Utah, just told me the other day that the faculty in his department, he's been retired now quite a few years, he said they have been telling him that our book stands as the basic book in the field that everybody's research is now based on. And so in that case, he and I were one of the first people to do premarital. Most family therapists paid little or no attention to premarital work. And even today in graduate programs, they give it hardly any attention. So we did it because we believed in that. Then we have a way of working with couples here. It's called the Rock Island Method, that we also put into a book form because we thought it was helpful for people to understand how we work with couples, which is different than the way most people do. And so that's in book form, and we did both. So I guess you could say both of these came out of very practical reasons.
Mm-hmm. I want to, before we run out of time, I want to talk a little bit about your guest preaching. I've heard you preach a couple of times only, but several of the people that I hang out over at VIK's APRIS, the Reading for the Blind service, because there's free coffee there, but on several occasions I've heard people say, I got to go to church tomorrow. Bill Hebert's the guest preacher. And I've heard you, and I would agree with them. What do you do sermons the same way? Do you dictate those? And
right, I do.
And a point, and then an example. A point, an example.
Right, or? I use that basic method, and the narrative part, the illustration, usually comes first for me, and so I'm preaching on last Sunday of November, which is Christ the King, which is the first last Sunday of the church year before Advent. And so I was I read the story, and of course the lesson for that day is the crucifixion. And so if you're sitting there thinking about this, and you're thinking, why are we reading about the crucifixion on the just at Thanksgiving time? And so the minute I thought about that, I thought about being someplace where you don't think it quite fits. And then what came to mind immediately was when I was in the parish in Winona, I was at Central Methodist, a very large church, you know, with a full carillonier, full-time carillonier, and set of bells, and gorgeous church built by the lumber money from Rock Island originally. And so here's this magnificent neo-Gothic church. Down the street was the Presbyterian church, and the Easter I was there, that Easter I discover afterwards, the pastor had listed all Christmas hymns in the bulletin. So when they came to the first hymn of the day, the Presbyterians were singing, O Little Town of Bethlehem. And so he then got up during an announcement and said, for those of you who only come to church twice a year, this year you'll only have to come once. And so what I was thinking about is what would it have been like to be sitting there thinking you're celebrating Easter and you're singing your Christmas hymn.
Right.
So that was what popped into my mind the minute I read the gospel. So I'm always automatically thinking about where does this come alive, you know? And so so when I do a sermon, I read the text, and then I try and go from what's going to make this, what's the central point. I never like to make more than about two or at the most 3 points, because people can't really remember more than that. And the stories are what people remember. The narrative is always important.
Well, it seems to me sermons are probably the hardest form of literature to get across to people. That's particularly true of students. I would come to my class, and I would assign a sermon, and there would be groans throughout the whole class.
Well,
kids get turned off by sermons,
yes.
but you have a way somehow of making that not happen.
Well, it's because I view a sermon as essentially a story. You're trying to make this come alive for people. I remember, you know, Harry Emerson Fosdick, the great American Baptist preacher of the 19th century and early 20th, said that the sermon is nothing but group counseling at its best. And I think the problem with many sermons, as I sat in the pew for many, many years now, is that, number one, if the pastor writes the sermon, he writes it in writing style rather than speaking style. And that's why I like to dictate sermons, because I dictate it as if I'm talking to you.
Right.
And I try and imagine I'm doing this conversation with you rather than writing it from a theoretical sort of perspective.
That's why I won't prepare speeches. It's risky, though. I don't know if you want to do that in the church, but I figure it's we'll just see what happens, see what is delivered in my imagination and facing the crowd and so on, and let it go.
And you, and in some settings, people will ask questions, so it directs you. And I agree. I think lectures that are read in our international conference, we're working on doing a video for people saying, this is how you present. Because we have people who come, especially Europeans, and they read a paper. And that is not our group of people. They would rather watch a videotape of therapy
right.
than listen to a paper.
Yeah, and the fact that you have eye contact with the crowd, you're not looking down and checking notes and so on, that you're just speaking
right.
to them. That direct contact will accomplish almost more than anything else.
And that's also why I always memorize a sermon so I can look at people.
Uh-huh.
Because I may decide to veer from the text like our president does.
Well, from books to sermons, you cover a lot of ground, Bill. We've been talking to Bill Hebert of Marriage and Family Counseling about his work as an author and as a preacher. And, Bill, we thank you very much for
Welcome.
Spending time with us. Roald, you mentioned assigning sermons in your class. Why would you do that?
Well, because I taught early American Lit, and people like Jonathan Edwards and others, the sermon was a really important vehicle for information in those days. There were, you know, you preached the sermon on Sunday's services lasted about 4 hours, and on Wednesday there was another sermon. So people got their fill of sermons.
Yeah, I guess. And I know people still read Jonathan Edwards' sermons.
They're still very good. I don't even want to get into that because he's gotten a bad rap for a sermon he wrote called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God that is hellfire and brimstone, but that is so untypical of Jonathan Edwards, who's most of whose sermons are very gentle and totally different from that one that has gotten all the press.
Yeah, well, that's the one Phyllis McGinley cited when she wrote her little poem about the very benches used to quake in awful agitation.
Our H.L. Mencken, Puritanism is that haunting fear that somewhere someone may be happy. Well, in fact, you know, we've done a hatchet job on the Puritans because we wanted to dismiss them, but they weren't the dour folks that you think they are.
They did one bad thing. They put their kids in cages at night, figuring that they were products of original sin and they had to be tamed. But they wore colorful clothes, and they seemed to have a lot of fun, but it was all within rigid guidelines.
The favorite gift for a newborn infant from a relative was called a cap of many colors. It was slices, pie-like slices of all sorts of different cloths. So it really was incredibly colorful.
Uh-huh. Well, from Puritans and sermons, let's go into somewhat recent news when there was conversation about perhaps purchasing Greenland, which everyone thought was a ludicrous idea. But as you I mentioned earlier, Truman wanted to buy it too back during the Cold War as a staging place to deal with Russia. But if you want to buy Greenland, the question is, what do you want? Do you want the ice or do you want the land? Because ice is what Greenland has in great quantity. But it is melting at an incredible rate. Millions and millions of tons of ice are coming off that. I think it, I wish I had the number, whether it's 50 million or 50 billion came off in about 5 days.
Yeah.
Between June and end of June, the beginning of August.
And if it all goes, up goes the ocean 7 feet around the world.
Yeah, that's right. And as it is, the currents in the ocean that circulate all around the globe, the deep currents and their surface currents, And one surface current that we're familiar with is the Gulf Stream, comes up the eastern face of the United States. And it is why you will find palm trees growing in Cornwall and in the southwestern part of Ireland, because warm water brings these things up, they take root, and they can grow. But that's warming, so, and slowing down. And as it slows, it warms. And that means that the sea will rise, and has risen along the eastern face of the United States, much faster than anywhere else in the world. And if all that water goes, it's going to be an epic mess. But there's a book out you might want to read, nonfiction, The Ice at the End of the World, An Epic Journey into Greenland's Buried Past and Our Perilous Future. It goes all the way back to that first trek in 1888 by a guy named Nansen, Fritjof Nansen, who crossed the land bulk of Greenland just to get an idea of how vast it was. And as we continue to measure the depth of the ice, it is just staggering. But what they've discovered now is that when the summer comes, it melts on the surface, but some of those melts go way down to the bottom, and now they're discovering that there's liquid at the bottom of some of the glaciers, and they're all moving a little faster. Now, Gertner's book will not bring you completely up to date, because the most alarming news is what came up just this summer, and that's the problem with books. If you're writing about something contemporary, by the time you get it in print, it may be out of date.
Right.
And that's probably true of Greenland. But anyway, if you'd like to look into it, it's called Ice at the End of the World by John Gertner. If you're still interested in water, there are some books that deal with ponds and with lakes. And they are equally interesting. One is Still Waters, The Secret World of Lakes by Kurt Stager. I think that's how you pronounce it, S-T-A-G-E-R. He's a limnologist, a paleoclimatologist, and ecologist. Limnology, that's the study of lakes, especially the sludge at the bottom of them. Isn't that something you'd like to take up? From Lake Baikal in Siberia, which is 20 million years old with sediment 4 miles deep, to Walden Pond, a kettle kale only 15,000 years old, apparently a melted iceberg. It's been trashed, improved, native fish gone. He gives you all kinds of information about lakes all around the world. It sounds rather too specialized, but it really is interesting. And I think you will find it an absorbing book. So you can read about Iceland, or you can go to lakes instead. Still Waters, The Secret World of Lakes by Kurt Stager. And there are other books on still water, but those are about ponds. We'll get into them for another time. But that's my offering in nonfiction books this time. The story of Greenland and the story of lakes all around the world. And I think if you read those, you'll not only be impressed with the scholarship, but perhaps just a little bit alarmed. And with that, we will turn to our theme and head for the exit. I'm Don Woot with Roll Tweet. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll look forward to seeing you next week for another issue of Scribble.